This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Sorry, there will be no moaning about American politics in this program. But wait, don't go away. We will find out why this winter in the Northern Hemisphere has been so cold in so many places, despite the world warming. If you are shivering, you will want to hear this. We have a top expert who predicts the secrets of winters for governments, corporations, and the military. Then we'll get more news science with the stunning news that greenhouse gases like methane can keep the sea rising for centuries, even though the gas itself disappears from the atmosphere in 10 or 12 years. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Prepare for more world wonders explained. Lately, the cold and snow has been hard on Istanbul, Turkey, and terrible for Bulgaria and the Ukraine. In Moscow, the Orthodox holiday was the coldest Christmas night in 120 years. I don't have to tell people in the U.S. Midwest or Northeast or Canada about driving Arctic cold and extra snow. Maybe you've heard of the Arctic vortex. How is this all happening under global warming? We'll cover that, but there is something else, a condition that helps weather specialists predict the kind of winter that's coming. To help us understand, I've reached Dr. Judah Cohen. He's worked at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies when James Hansen was the director. Cohen has been a research scientist at MIT Parsons Laboratory. Since 1998, he's continued to publish scientific papers while employed by the weather consulting company Atmospheric and Environmental Research. Governments, the military, and private industry are helped by his work as he teases climate science into the near future. From Lexington, Massachusetts, Dr. Cohen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
In late December 2016, January 2017, there are waves of abnormally cold weather, sometimes with heavy snow across the Northern Hemisphere. It seems to be a parade of slightly warmer weather and then crushing cold we associate with the Arctic. Judah, is that an accurate picture?
Yeah, I mean, I think the headlines have been about the cold weather, the snow, and here in North America, but also in Europe and East Asia. You know, crushing cold with a little bit of warmth, I guess that depends where you live. I mean, the cold has been focused further west in North America. Here in the East Coast, it's kind of been a toss-up, which has been winning out. So always, I guess, it's, you know, the weather, very much sensitive to weather that's happening in your own backyard, just to be clear on that.
Yeah, that's true. You know, we had cold snaps when I was growing up in Canada, but we assumed what happened in the Arctic stayed in the Arctic. Is that still true, or has something changed?
Yeah, you know, that's a very big debate in the climate community, and something that has been an ongoing debate for a few years, and we're going to have actually a workshop in the beginning of February where we're going to all get together, many of the leading scientists in this topic, and try to come to a consensus, but the consensus still doesn't exist. I personally am in the camp that believes that what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic, but I would characterize that most of the community believes that what happens in the Arctic does stay in the Arctic. I mean, I think, you know, this year is a good example. I think a lot of the recent years are good examples of that we've had these simultaneous extreme warmths in the Arctic. Certainly part of that is attributed to low sea ice, not all of it, but some of it is attributed to that low sea ice. And yet, the expectations, the projections were that warmth in the Arctic would kind of spread out to lower latitudes, and the whole Northern Hemisphere would warm, you know, in concert with the warming in the Arctic. And I've tried to argue, and others as well, that hasn't been the case, that actually when the Arctic warms, especially when it warms at extremely, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's when you get this extreme warmth in the Arctic, that actually favors these outbreaks of more severe or extreme winter weather, including cold snaps and snowstorms. And there certainly doesn't seem to be any lack of examples of that this year. And it's certainly been also what I think is this year makes a good example is that it hasn't been isolated to one location. You know, it's not just one place, but it's been kind of an equal opportunity, you know, winter where many places across the globe, like you started, you know, you mentioned in your introduction, have experienced pretty wild winter weather with, what I would characterize as extreme cold and extreme snowfall.
Do you think that's going to be true for the UK, Scandinavian Europe, or are they safer somehow sliding between these two big continents?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, the winter isn't over, and certainly the weather models are suggestive that that cold air will head towards Western Europe. So it's certainly been focused, you know, so far this month in Eastern Europe, Southeast Europe. I mean, Turkey and Greece and Italy, they've all, certainly the pictures have come out of there with these incredible snowfalls and the extreme cold temperatures in, you know, Moscow, Poland, and the Balkans, and Bulgaria. But the weather models are suggesting that cold, I don't think to that intensity, but that cold will start sliding further west. And so I think the United Kingdom, you know, will certainly get a taste of it, maybe even possibly some snow. But the UK is a very difficult place to forecast snow. And it doesn't happen that often because they stick so far out in the ocean and are very close to the Gulf Stream. But we'll see. It should be some interesting couple of weeks coming up.
So what's the debate among scientists about whether the deep snows and the cold hitting the northeastern U.S. in recent years is or is not related to the shrinking Arctic sea ice?
Yeah, so the majority of the climate community believes or agrees that the cold that we've experienced has been really random, or it's been by chance, that, you know, there's a lot of variability in the system, in the climate system, and, you know, sometimes it comes out warm, sometimes it comes out cold, so, you know, you have a couple of, even a streak of two or three cold winters, you know, that's just, you know, good luck, bad luck, depending on your perspective, but it's really just luck. And I've certainly not been in that camp. I don't believe in coincidences that strongly, and I think it has to be put in the context, in the framework, that the projections have been for, you know, pretty rapidly warming winter season, that cold and snow would become a rare event, and it doesn't seem to be the case, that over the past decade, I would argue that the headlines have more been about severe winter weather and less about, you know, record warmth and a lack of winter.
Yeah, in 2006, I did a show about whether winter sports would be over, and that certainly hasn't been the case. And I can remember, it wasn't, maybe around 2009, 2010, people were playing tennis in New York in January, and we thought, well, that's it, winter's over. But winter isn't over.
Yeah, no, and there have been some famous articles in the New York Times, you know, where people are bemoaning or, you know, kind of putting a eulogy to snow in New York City, and and that certainly seems premature. Last winter, they had their record biggest snowstorm. And you know, it's not just isolated to New York, but that's been in other places as well. But yeah, there have been these projections that winter's over. You know, it's something that our fathers experience, or you know, maybe we experience if we're a little older, but our children won't really experience that type of winter weather. And so far, I don't think, you know, it's been that the winters have. I mean, they're different. I mean, things are changing. So I don't want to oversimplify. I mean, certainly, I think winters are starting later. The falls have been very warm, and I think maybe the fall is the season that's been warming the fastest, which was supposed to be the winter, but that's not happening. So I mean, there is this shifting in the seasons. I mean, I don't know if winters are ending any sooner. I know overall people report that the freezing season or the snowfall season is getting shorter. But, you know, so there are definitely shifts, and I would characterize that the winter, you know, the season of winter weather maybe has been getting shorter, but when it does happen, it seems to be getting more intense.
Let's look at some of the tools that you and all scientists use when they study these matters. For example, what is the Arctic Oscillation?
Yeah, so the Arctic Oscillation, I think the easiest way to understand it, it's just a metric. It measures the exchange of air masses between the high latitudes and the low latitudes. So when the Arctic Oscillation is positive, there's very little mixing of air masses going on. So the cold air stays over the Arctic, the warmer air stays over the mid-latitudes, right? You have this strong kind of temperature gradient, but then across the mid-latitudes, it tends to be you have a milder pattern, warmer temperatures, less snowfall, because the respective air masses are staying where they're supposed to be, right? So what happens in the Arctic stays in the Arctic kind of idea. And then when you have a negative Arctic oscillation, that means there's much more mixing of the air masses going on. So the Arctic air, the cold air, doesn't stay in the Arctic now. It's displaced southward into the mid-latitudes, and then warm air that's at lower and mid-latitudes rushes into the Arctic, and you get these kind of extreme warm events. And, you know, and you get this more extreme or severe winter weather in the mid-latitudes because you also the mixing of air masses is conducive to storms, and if it's cold enough, that brings you snowstorms.
Can we predict when this Arctic oscillation will shift? Do we know that yet?
Again, most of the field has expressed this idea that the Arctic oscillation is kind of random. It's just kind of a measure of the noise or the randomness in the system, and therefore it's unpredictable. I've tried to predict the Arctic oscillation, and this is for the winter season. It exists all year round, but I mean, that's what we're talking about today is really the winter season, and I've tried to prove or to support the idea that it can be predicted using a Eurasian snow cover. So if you look at snow cover across Eurasia in the month of October, that can give you an indication of the Arctic oscillation. So when the snow cover is high, that predicts, or let's say the odds are tilted towards a negative Arctic oscillation, so more of this mixing of the air masses between the high and lower latitudes, maybe more severe winter weather across the mid-latitudes. And when that snow cover is low, then that kind of portends or predicts a positive Arctic oscillation. Less mixing of the air masses, the cold air stays in the Arctic, the warmer air stays in the mid-latitudes, you have a milder winter. As I get along in my career, I do think that the Arctic oscillation itself is an overly simplistic metric. And I've actually kind of shifted away from the Arctic oscillation more towards the kind of a framework of the polar vortex, which is the same idea, but I think there are times when you get these outbreaks of severe cold and snow and doesn't really match up with what's going on with this Arctic oscillation, just the way it's constructed. But I think there's a strong relationship with what's happening with the polar vortex. And just like when you have a negative Arctic oscillation, the strong mixing, the same thing happens with a weak polar vortex. When you have much more mixing of the air mass, that tends to weaken the polar vortex, which is this kind of this low pressure that sits in the stratosphere right over the North Pole and, you know, spins around very quickly. The air circulates around the polar vortex in a west-east direction. And when the vortex is very strong, that kind of keeps those air masses between the Arctic and the lower latitudes separated. Right, it acts like a fence or a dam, and you know, similar to when you have a positive Arctic oscillation. And then when you have a weakening of the polar vortex, and the winds start to meander more in the north-south direction, you get much more mixing of the air masses. Warm air rushes into the polar stratosphere that weakens the polar vortex, sometimes very quite dramatically. And then that cold air that was confined inside of that polar vortex then spills out to mid-latitudes, and you get this more severe winter weather. So that's kind of now I've tried to move my thinking, my framework, more towards this kind of polar vortex type context, more so than the Arctic oscillation, I think, at least for winter. In the summer, there is no polar vortex, so it doesn't work at all. But at least for the winter, I think maybe it's a better indicator of the type of weather you could expect. You know, in these areas that we discuss, you know, United States, Southern Canada, Europe, and as well East Asia also.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Judah Cohen, and we're talking about winters and predicting winters, and he's from the American company Atmospheric and Environmental Research. You know, Judah, until a few years ago, the public never heard of the Arctic vortex. Why did it suddenly appear in TV weather forecasting?
Yes, that's a good question. I don't have a good answer. I mean, it really came to be used in the media in January 2014. There was a very strong Arctic outbreak beginning of that month. It was like a January 6th, 7th, but you know, record cold to the Midwest and then the eastern United States, southern Canada as well, you know, southeastern Canada. And, you know, the media picked it up. People take credit for it. I don't know. I don't think it was actually the best example, the poster child for using the polar vortex. I think the winter before that, 2012-13, would have been a much better example. But at first I was like, you know, horrified, because I thought they were, you know, not using in the proper context because again, the polar vortex in the purest sense sits in the stratosphere, and they were talking about something that is here in, you know, in the troposphere, in the weather, you know, the atmosphere closer to the ground. But I've, since then, I've, you know, we can't beat them, join them. I've come to embrace much more this use of the term polar vortex. And I do think that used properly, that it can give quite a bit of insight into the upcoming weather. And again, I'm trying to predict these different phases or stages of the polar vortex, the strong versus weak. I think it's actually, there are more different configurations to the polar vortex than just, it's not just a binary system. It's not just strong or weak, but there are other different flavors, let's say, to the polar vortex that, you know, can be used for prediction, and the prediction, you know, in the longer term, not just, you know, we use our weather models to maybe make the forecast for the next week, 10 days possibly, but then it really falls apart. I think that we can, by, you know, understanding other, these different configurations or these different phases, I don't know, maybe what's the best word to use that your audience will understand and be able to internalize the concept I'm trying to get across. But in scientifically, I guess we'd say the different phases of the polar vortex. I think that could be used to make these longer range forecasts, you know, 1 week, 2 week, 3 weeks, even, you know, even like 4 weeks or longer. I think it was a good addition and a kind of a different perspective. I mean, it's an idea that's been around in meteorology for a very long time. It wasn't invented in 2014. You know, something that's been discussed for decades before that.
So just to be clear, though, in scientific terms, you're thinking that the real polar vortex is way up in the upper atmosphere, the stratospheric polar vortex, but now we're starting to use it for lower-level weather?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. So really, in the pure sense, and what, you know, climatologists and meteorologists, when we talked about the polar vortex, was really in the stratosphere, which is like, you know, 10 miles up in the atmosphere. And then when it was used colloquially, in 2014, right, by the media, it was really talking about the weather closer to the surface. So there's something analogous that goes on in the weather to the surface to the polar vortex, but, I mean, I think that has kind of gotten muddled and confused. And But, again, there's this connection, this relationship between what happens in the stratosphere and the troposphere, not all the time, but sometimes. And I think that can be capitalized to improve longer-range forecasts, so...
And I'd like to look at a couple of predictions you made in October 2016. First, for the United States, you predicted a colder and more snowy winter from the plains to the northeast. How's that panning out?
Yeah, so, you know, looking at North America, we had cold in western Canada and then kind of coming southeastward into the, you know, into the plains, the Great Lakes, into the northeast. So eastern New England, I think, was above normal. So the jury's still out on that. The cold further west, you know, in the plains, I think western Canada, that looks to work out. I think the northeast, a lot of it will come down to how February shapes up. But, yeah, so I think, you know, it's a toss-up. I think temperatures are pretty close to normal if you average, you know, the temperatures from December 1st right through today. But we do have a much milder period coming up, so that'll probably tilt it back into the warm column. But again, a cold February, I think, will tilt the whole winter to cold. So, you know, the jury's still out on how, I mean, in certain parts of the forecast, I think, you know, the cold in the western part of the forecast region, western Canada, the, you know, the plains of the United States, I think that's looking pretty good.
Yeah, we had pipe freezing cold here in British Columbia. I mean, it was very unusual cold. I want to move on, though. Secondly, you agreed with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, when they said dry weather would predominate in California. And in the second week of January, the whole Pacific coast was drenched with an atmospheric river of extreme rainfall, plus snow in the mountains. Could that be enough to break the long drought in California? What's your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a hydrologist. I mean, I don't think I came out with a forecast. I mean, we do have, you know, produce a precipitation forecast. I don't think I really talked about it in the public, but it probably did agree with NOAA. I will fully admit that our precipitation forecast heavily relies on the phase of the El Nino Southern Oscillation, which is what NOAA is using to make their precipitation forecast as well. So I'm going to have to check on it. I mean, I probably was... Our forecast was for dry in California, so I won't deny, but I don't remember coming out publicly with that. But obviously, you know, there's, you know, a tremendous amount of moisture that California has gotten already and is still predicted to get. it should make a big difference in the drought. I don't know if it'll completely erase it. I mean, some of the issues there is that right now it's pretty warm, so they're getting more rain and snow, and the most beneficial for them is snow and not rain. But, I mean, they've gotten a lot of snow, and I guess it'll continue to snow at the higher elevations, but it's a pretty warm system, it seems like. At least currently it's warm. I assume it'll get colder, and the snow levels will come down. But it should make a big difference, but this is not, it's not my expertise.
But you do seem to be a hybrid mix because, you know, in my opinion, too many meteorologists won't take advantage of climate change science, and then most climate scientists won't talk about the coming winter at all. They want to talk about decades at least. How did you bridge these two fields?
Yeah, so it's a point I think I don't get enough credit for, and I certainly get a lot of grief. I'm one of the few, maybe really the only, I don't know anybody else, at the top of my head, climate scientist, a guy who's publishing papers. I mean, there are people that are putting out forecasts, but, the people that are in the private sector, let's say, or even in the government labs that are putting out these forecasts, they're not really conducting research. And the ones that are conducting research and publishing the scientific journal articles aren't putting out forecasts. And I feel like I'm pretty unique in that, in doing both the research and the forecast. And I do think that it certainly helped guide, the research has helped guide the forecast, and the forecasts have helped guide the research. And I think, and I would argue, maybe people might say differently, but I would argue it's been to my benefit. It's one thing to put out research ideas and kind of live in this, academic ivory tower where, even if it's complete nonsense and doesn't improve forecasts, you don't really care because you're not involved with making forecasts. That's someone else's problem. But, I mean, I don't have that luxury. If I put out an idea and I'm saying this is going to improve seasonal, long-range forecasting, I'm putting my money where my mouth is, and I'm making these forecasts and being given to clients or being made public, and certainly trying not to embarrass myself at the same time. Now, the forecasts are certainly not perfect, but I think I've had a very good track record of these public forecasts. I think our forecasts that we make here today have been the best, certainly in the winter season. And I think it's been a very good and healthy exercise, and I would recommend to other scientists to also try to, if you really believe strongly in an idea, that there's no better way to prove or to test that idea than to make a forecast and see if it verifies.
Well, as we talked about, we kind of hoped winter would be over with global warming, but how are we ever going to tell billions of humans, if you experience a harsher winter, it's because the world is warming? How can we tell them that?
I've had an interesting experience with saying how Arctic change is influencing the winter weather. People have, called me, an apologist for climate, global warming or climate change, or even people call me a denier of climate change. I think people, it's gotten very politicized, very polarized, like much of the politics. And I don't have any good answers. I mean, again, I myself try to keep an open mind and seeing how our climate's changing, and then trying to, be opportunistic about it to improve long range forecasting. But I think it's a very difficult and almost maybe intractable problem. I don't have any good answers for you, because people see what they want to see. I guess I've been around long enough, at least to get, and have that type of philosophy ingrained in me. But I mean, I really focus on just making a better forecast and not trying to, convince people, what to believe or not to believe.
So why are these forecasts so important? I mean, who uses this information? Why do we need it?
Well, I think, being prepared is important. I mean, first of all, if you know, so, I mean, traditionally our clients have been people in the energy sector. If you know what the winter is going to be, if it's going to be a cold winter or a warm winter, you can position your assets, whatever, your money, to make the best opportunity of that. So if it's a cold winter, you want to be invest in oil and gas, whatever, but I mean, maybe gas is more sensitive, natural gas more sensitive than oil to the weather. But, that type of thing, I mean, that's just, a very basic and just, investment-oriented perspective. But, even from a public, the government, in the public sector, if you're a city and you if you think there could be a chance of a lot of snowfall, so you know you prepare for that as well. You maybe you have enough salt, you have enough snow plows, you know, available. And, you know, then let's say maybe you know you're expecting less snow, you could prepare for that as well. So I think both in the private and the public sector, the weather has a big impact, and being prepared for the possible scenarios and outcomes, you know, can be very useful. Save money, make people's lives easier as well.
Where do you think climate science has to go to help meteorologists become more certain about near-term predictions?
Most of the field has relied on these dynamical models for prediction. I mean, it is a tough question you asked me, but since you asked, I'll answer it. And again, this is really my own opinion and no one else's, but you know, we've built these dynamical models, and they're very good, and they've made tremendous improvements in forecasting, but they certainly have their limitations. And I think, you know, the atmosphere, you know, in theory, there could be every day, in that, you know, of weather could be different than the day before, and no 2 days are ever alike, you know, like snowflakes. But the atmosphere, I think, you know, it does something interesting. It likes to fall into certain types of patterns. It repeats these patterns over and over again. And I think, you know, you come to appreciate that, you know, in climate science. And, you know, so I think that's an area that, you know, I've tried to exploit. And I think there can be, you know, a benefit. Now, you know, I feel like the field has really kind of become more and more reliant on these dynamical models where they're solving the equations, these physical equations explicitly. They're, you know, crunching them out with the computer. But I think... And I think we should certainly move in that direction, but I also think we've kind of moved away from this kind of pattern recognition. Old-time meteorologists like to talk about analogs, which I'm actually not the greatest fan of, but I think we can use pattern. I'm using pattern recognition, you know, kind of this idea. I'm not a computer, but this idea of recognizing patterns. So like I said, high snow cover leads to a colder winter, that type of pattern recognition or relationship. I think more of that could improve these, you know, longer range forecasts. That's certainly where I've, you know, focused my own energy and research on. So, I mean, it's a very subjective answer, admittedly, and someone else would, I'm sure, give you a very, very different answer.
You know, I could see it's possible that artificial intelligence may eventually help us. We're dealing with these gigantic data sets of global information. It's possible that some machine just going over and over and over that may bring out a new pattern that we hadn't thought about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the point you make is a great one, and I agree with that.
As we finish up here, is there anything else you'd like to add to tell our listeners?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, just traditionally, you know, the climate community has relied on the tropics for making these longer range forecasts, and only the tropics were thought to really be able to influence the weather in the mid-latitudes. And, you know, myself and some others, we've really said, especially given the rapid changes that are going in the Arctic, the changes are much larger than happening anywhere else across the globe, that these rapid changes in the Arctic, I think, is providing, I don't know, more opportunities. Not something like the right way to put it, but... increases the likelihood that the Arctic is influencing the weather in the mid-latitudes just because the changes are so large there. And I think that it does provide us with an additional or new capabilities or abilities to improve our forecast, you know, in the mid-latitudes. And certainly something that I'm really very much focused on is kind of trying to use both the tropics and the Arctic to complement each other, you know, synergistically to improve, you know, long-range forecast, so I think it's been kind of the cornerstone of my career so far. So I mean, there's one, you know, one thought I'd like to leave everybody with is, you know, that embracing the idea that we can bring in, you know, Arctic variability and Arctic change into improving these long-range forecasts across the whole Northern Hemisphere.
We've been speaking with Dr. Judah Cohen from the Company Atmospheric and Environmental Research. He's a much published scientist whose seasonal weather predictions ran counter to some established expectations, but he's been pretty accurate. He's been on television and often sought out by journalists. I'll put links to Judah's information and a couple of key papers he recommends in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Judah, thank you so much for taking this time to talk with us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, again, you know, it was a pleasure to talk about all my favorite subjects, so happy to do so.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
We humans release greenhouse gases beyond carbon dioxide, but we don't hear much about them because they don't last as long in the atmosphere. Now we learn these gases can cause sea levels to rise for centuries even after they disappear. And that comes in a new paper led by Kirsten Zickfeld, one of the bright young women scientists coming up in the climate field. Trained in Germany, Kirsten is an associate professor of geography at Canada's Simon Fraser University. One of her co-authors is Susan Solomon, the famous atmospheric chemist from MIT. The new science was published December 2016 in one of the world's top journals, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS. Kirsten Zickfeld, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, right off the bat, how is it possible that a greenhouse gas that lasts 10 years or less could keep driving sea levels higher more than 200 years later?
This has to do with the long memory of the ocean. So the ocean doesn't forget changes that we affect today actually induce changes to the ocean that can last for centuries. And this has to do with ocean circulation. So it takes a long time for the heat to make it into the deep ocean. And on the other hand, the heat that makes it to the deep ocean also takes a very long time to be released. And this is what determines the very long time scale of changes in the ocean.
So it sort of gets hidden in the seas for a while.
That's right. So there's a what is called an overturning circulation that moves the heat at the surface to the deep ocean, and then it's stored in the very deep ocean, and actually takes centuries or even up to a millennium to actually be brought back to the surface again. So this means it takes a really, really long time for the heat that enters the ocean at a certain point in time to be released.
I found myself asking, what were the questions that drove you and your co-authors to do this research?
There is a misconception out there that if we eliminate emissions of these short-lived gases that remain in the atmosphere for a relatively short period of time, so here we're talking about decades to centuries, which is still long, but much shorter than actually carbon dioxide, which stays in the atmosphere for several centuries. So the idea out there is that as we eliminate emissions of these gases, also the climate effects will go away, which means if we stop emitting methane, that also the climate effects of methane will actually disappear. But because of this long memory of the ocean that we just discussed, that's actually not the case. But the climate effects persist much longer than the time span that the gas remains in the atmosphere. And so there was a study a few years ago which showed that actually temperature persists much longer than the gases stay in the atmosphere. So what drove us was to ask, how about sea level? So what is the sea level effect? How long does the sea level effect actually persist?
And you've done several papers on the possibilities to reverse climate change. Why do you keep working on that?
Because I'm not very optimistic about us meeting these climate targets that are in the Paris Agreement. So there's a lot of talk about the 1.5 degree target and the 2 degree target. And with current emission levels and commitment by different nations, these climate targets are actually very difficult to achieve. And so the question out there is, if we overshoot these targets or if we exceed these targets, can we actually come back one day? So let's say if we exceed 2 degrees, is there a possibility that by reducing greenhouse gases, we might actually come back to 2 degrees? Perhaps a decade or a century later. And for temperature, what the research over the last decade actually showed that even if we eliminate emissions of greenhouse gases completely, temperature will remain stable. So that is, even if we reduce or even if we totally eliminate emissions of those gases, then the temperature will remain stable. And regarding sea level rise, what the research indicates is that actually for carbon dioxide, even if we eliminate emissions of carbon dioxide entirely, then sea level will continue to rise. And so the question here was, if we eliminate emissions of the short-lived gases that remain in the atmosphere for shorter time than actually carbon dioxide, can we get sea levels to actually to come down or to decrease again?
Well, let's talk about methane, or as the British would say, methane. Will long-term sea level rise due to methane be significant?
Well, currently, the warming due to methane is about a third of the current warming effect. So methane is actually a significant greenhouse gas at the moment, not as strong as carbon dioxide, but still a significant greenhouse gas. And if we continue to emit methane into the atmosphere, then yes, then the sea level contributions due to methane will be significant. And what our paper really shows is that they will persist last for a very long period of time. So that is, even if we eliminate methane emissions, let's say in 2050, then we will see the sea level effects of those methane emissions for several centuries after that.
You know, I'm curious about your calculation of how potent methane is compared to carbon dioxide. And I ask because there have been greatly different figures published for that. For years, the IPCC described methane as 25 times more powerful than CO2. Others have said it's 75 times more powerful during its decade of life, or even over 100 times. What number would you use?
I would say it depends really on the question that you're asking. So I think what you're referring to are these so-called global warming potentials that compare the warming effect of different greenhouse gases. And this is very important for agreements such as the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement, which will allow one to compare the climate effect of different greenhouse gases. So this factor actually depends on the time horizon or on the time span that you're looking at. So, for example, if we're interested in long-term warming, then it makes sense to take this global warming potential for a longer period of time. But if we're more interested in the short-term effect, then it makes more sense to take this global warming potential for a shorter period of time. So I would say it really depends on the question that is asked. So it is actually a very important question, because if this factor is calculated incorrectly, then let's say by reducing methane emissions at the expense of carbon dioxide emissions, we may end up with a much higher warming than we were actually aiming for. So it is important to get those numbers right.
Well, I'm sure you're aware some scientists fear methane will increase a lot more in the coming decades as the permafrost thaws, or if frozen sea bottom methane called clathrates are released. Were you able to work possible changes in methane emissions into your study?
Here we only look at methane emissions that are put into the system by oil and gas production and agriculture and landfills. So these are so-called emissions that are external to the climate system. So we're actually not looking at the feedbacks that you're referring to. So here in our study, we do not consider methane that is released into the atmosphere due to thawing of permafrost, which then amplifies the warming, which then thaws even more permafrost and then releases even more methane into the atmosphere. So this vicious cycle or feedback loop is actually not accounted for in our study. But I would say still the results are relevant, because they show that once the methane is in the system or is in the atmosphere, then it has a very long legacy. So its effects last for a very long period of time.
Industrial sources of significant methane, whether it's the fracking industry or gas pipeline operators, tend to wish away the impacts by saying, well, methane's short-lived and it's not consequential. Kirsten Zickfeld, your paper seems to challenge that claim.
That's exactly the point. So this is what we were, that's what the main point of the paper was, to actually show that these gases, even if their time in the atmosphere is relatively short, their climate effects are actually very long-lived.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Kirsten Zickfeld, an associate professor at Simon Fraser University's Department of Geography on Canada's Wet West Coast. She's the lead author of an important new study, Centuries of Thermal Sea Level Rise Due to Anthropogenic Emissions of Short-Lived Greenhouse Gases. You can find a link to that in my weekly show blog. Well, Kirsten, I'd like to move on to another set of lesser-known greenhouse gases. These are the chlorofluorocarbons, better known as CFCs, and their replacement chemicals. You're the lead author on this paper, but I'm wondering if the expertise of Professor Susan Solomon of MIT helped develop the example of chlorofluorocarbons.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So she had the idea of looking at the effect of the Montreal Protocol. So the Montreal Protocol came into force in the 80s and banned ozone-destructing substances such as these chlorofluorocarbons. So as an illustration of the long-lasting climate effects of these so-called short-lived gases, we looked at the effect of banning these gases through the Montreal Protocol. And what we found is that through early action, so by banning these greenhouse gases in the 80s, we actually avoided up to around 14 centimeters of sea level rise by 2050. So what this illustrates is that early action on these short-lived greenhouse gases can actually avoid quite a bit of the climate effect.
Well, I found that case study very interesting because the fossil fuel industry and their politicians continue to push a very gradual phase out of coal, oil, and gas, and that's despite a recent study showing the carbon budget that would keep us under 1.5 degrees, the danger line, will be spent sometime next year in 2018. Is there a way to use your case study on a ban versus phase out in the case of fossil fuels as well?
Well, what I would say is that our study shows that there are no trade-offs and that we need to mitigate emissions of both the short-lived gases, methane and chlorofluorocarbons and their substitutes, as well as those of the long-lived gases such as carbon dioxide. So both set of gases have very long-lived effects, and so we need, in order to minimize the impact on sea level and on temperature in the long term, we really need to reduce emissions of these gases as early as possible.
Now, the CFCs we produced before the ban, how long will they remain in the atmosphere?
The CFCs have an atmospheric lifetime of around 50 years, 50 to 100 years. There are substitutes such as the hydrochlorocarbons and hydrofluorocarbons actually have lifetimes on the order of decades, basically. They stay in the atmosphere a lesser time than carbon dioxide, but a little bit longer than methane, for example.
But if their CFCs last, say, up to 50 years or longer, they're still up there. So how can anybody talk about reductions in the ozone hole when most of the ozone-depleting chemicals are still there?
Well, the ozone hole, it's not that as soon as we reduce these gases, the ozone hole will disappear. I think the good news is, and my co-author Susan Solomon published a paper on this recently, is that the ozone hole is healing, which means that it's getting better, but it's not that it's going away right away. So this means as we phase out emissions of these gases, their atmospheric concentration decreases, but it's not that they disappear from one day to the other. So this means that even in the case of the ozone hole, the effects still last for some decades. But the atmosphere reacts relatively quickly to those changes. So let's say the ozone hole is an example where the ocean is not involved, and so it can heal itself much more quickly than, let's say, the ocean, which has these very long response timescales.
Kirsten, I'm kind of in awe that your paper was edited by one of the greats in atmospheric pollution, Dr. V. Ramanathan from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He's a pioneer that I've admired for years, and he talks about how pollution can mitigate some of our heating or maybe even cool us. I wonder if that's partly why you and your co-authors added that question and answer on sea level rise, even if temperatures stabilize or go down.
The reason we looked into this is that there's a bit of a debate there in climate science and also climate community about what pays off more. Is it reducing these short-lived greenhouse gases such as methane and these halocarbons we talked about, but also things like black carbon or soot in the atmosphere? Or does it pay off more to actually mitigate carbon dioxide? So on one side of the debate, people say, well, we should actually reduce these short-lived gases more quickly because it's easier to do and it will have an instant effect. Whereas on the other side of the debate, people say, well, the long-term effects are those caused by carbon dioxide, so we cannot reduce emissions of these short-lived gases at the expense of carbon dioxide, because those will determine the long-term climate effect. Sort of with our paper, we wanted to contribute to that debate, and I think what it really shows is that we need to reduce emissions of both, so both the short-lived gases and the long-lived gases, such as carbon dioxide.
Well, frankly, until I read your paper, I thought sea levels rose with the temperature and fell with the two, because that's broadly what the paleoclimate record shows, isn't it?
Yeah, I think sort of here we're talking about different time scales. So if you're looking at the temperature record, so that's usually on time scales of at least millennia to tens and hundreds of thousands of years. Whereas here we're really looking at centuries. So here we're looking at the human time scale. So the question that we're asking is, if one generation puts these gases into the atmosphere and then stops emitting those gases, will they actually reap the benefits of doing so? So I would say, compared to these paleo studies, we're looking at the different time scale here. So if we look at the millennial time scale, then the sea level rise effects will disappear at some point. So that's right. So I think perhaps this apparent contradiction comes from the different time scales.
So following the science done in 2013 by UK scientist Nathaniel Boots, is there a different gauge or reason why sea levels change other than temperature?
Yes. So something I should clarify here, and which we haven't talked about, is that our study only deals with what is called thermal expansion, which is the volume change of the ocean due to heating. And then there are other contributions to sea level rise that come from melting ice. So melting mountain glaciers, melting ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica. So again, if we look at the paleo record, then usually it includes all these different contributions, because it's very difficult to actually model sea level rise from melting ice. We have limited our study to the thermal expansion contribution. So what the study by Boot did, and also several studies in the past, is to assume that sea level rise increases at the same rate as actually temperature does. And if we look at the past, then that's actually the case. So we can look at the sea level rise curve, and we can look at that temperature, and we will see that they actually increase together. However, what we find is that this linear relationship, or this proportional relationship, doesn't work if the concentration of these gases in the atmosphere decreases and also their radiative effect decreases. So as soon as we stop emitting these gases and the radiative effect actually decreases, then we found that this proportional relationship doesn't work anymore, and that we have to take other effects into account.
Now, suppose efforts to develop carbon capture and storage become successful on a commercial scale, or other geoengineering plots actually lower global temperatures by a degree or more. Would the sea levels still go up?
So we did not address these geoengineering measures here specifically. And I would also make a distinction between different geoengineering methodologies that have been proposed. So there are those that seek to reduce the amount of sunlight that enters the atmosphere. So those are usually referred to as solar radiation management techniques. And then there are others that are called carbon dioxide removal techniques that try to artificially lower the content of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So we did not address these techniques in our study explicitly, but what we can actually learn from our calculations is that if we were successful in developing these techniques, particularly these carbon dioxide removal techniques. So just to give you an example, this could be fertilizing the ocean with iron to increase the amount of carbon dioxide that is actually taken up by the ocean. So this would be one of those measures that is being talked about. So if we're able to do this, then what our study shows is that even if the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is reduced more rapidly than the natural removal of carbon dioxide would allow for, then we could bring down temperature, but actually sea level would still remain elevated. So this means that even with these geoengineering measures, it's actually very difficult to reverse sea level rise. Yeah, so what this means is that the long-lasting nature of sea level rise implies that rising sea levels is a circumstance that we'll have to deal with for a very long period of time.
I'm also interested in an earlier paper where you were the lead author, published in 2015 in the journal Environmental Research Letters. The title is "The Time Lag Between a Carbon Dioxide Emission and Maximum Warming Increases with the Size of the Emission." Could you briefly tell us what is the lesson from that?
So that paper was a comment on a prior paper by Katie Ricke and Ken Caldera. And what they showed is that if we put a certain amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, then the maximum warming in response to that carbon dioxide will occur very quickly, so within a decade. And conversely, what they concluded is that if we remove a certain amount of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, then also the climate effects will occur very quickly, or if we avoid a certain amount of carbon put into the atmosphere, which is important because it means that the generation that actually reduces the emissions will also see the benefit of those emission reductions. So the point we made in that paper is that there's some time lag between the emission or the avoided emission and the temperature effect really depends on how much carbon we put into the atmosphere. So if we emit a lot, then that lag actually increases. So it means that the effect of the carbon dioxide will see, or the maximum effect will be seen more than a decade into the future.
Okay, now you did your postdoctoral research at Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany, and I find that's impressive because so much powerful climate science comes from there. How did you find being there?
I did my postdoc there, but I already did my PhD at the Potsdam Institute. So that was a fabulous experience because it is a whole institute that deals with climate science. So climate science and also the economic and social implications of climate change. So this means that there's a whole institute that looks at climate change in its entirety, so at the science, at the implications on, let's say, food production, water availability. It looks at ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And it was incredibly inspiring to work in such an interdisciplinary environment, which I think in terms of climate change is very important because it is such a broad topic that has so many consequences for different aspects of society.
What will you be working on next?
So at the moment, I'm really interested in some carbon dioxide removal. And the reason is something I suggested or I alluded to earlier is that in my view, it will be very difficult to meet the 2-degree climate target. And if we look at the scenarios that are used in the IPCC to actually hit this target, they already bake these carbon dioxide removal technologies in. So they're already in the scenarios that are used by the IPCC. And also others argue that if we miss the target, then perhaps at a later point in time, we could actually remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and then go back to that target. So far, what we understand very well scientifically is how the climate system reacts to increasing emissions of or to putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But we do not understand very well how the system reacts to actually taking these greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. So we do not know how the carbon cycle reacts to that and how reversible the changes will actually be. So this is something that strongly interests me.
Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners as we wrap up here?
Yeah, what I would like to say is that really the main conclusion from our study is that there are no trade-offs between reducing emissions of short and long-lived greenhouse gases, and that if in the long term we want to limit warming and sea level rise, then really we have to tackle both as early as possible.
We've been talking about a surprising long-lasting effect even from greenhouse gases that don't stick around that long in the atmosphere. The paper is Centuries of Thermal Sea Level Rise Due to Anthropogenic Emissions of Short-Lived Greenhouse Gases, as published in PNAS in December 2013. Our guest from Simon Fraser University is the lead author, Kirsten Zickfeld. Find the links you need to find out more in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Kirsten, thank you so much for your work and for talking with us on Radio EcoShock. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This paper by Zickfeld, Solomon, and Guilford ties into a long-running debate in the climate science community. In September 29, 2004, in the dark days of the oil men Bush and Cheney in the White House, a muzzled Dr. James Hansen of NASA suggested dangerous climate interference could be averted by controlling methane. At the time, I thought, well, what else can he say? They're not going to do anything about oil. But now that paper by Hansen and Mikiko Sato looks more important. I covered that whole story in my show for October 25, 2006, with a blog titled The Methane Fix. Since then, we've had David Archer, a leading climate scientist from the University of Chicago, on Radio EcoShock, telling us worrying about methane is a distraction from the real deal, carbon dioxide. We know carbon dioxide will wreck the planet, while possible increases in methane from the Arctic are still in the future, he says. With this broadcast, we come back full circle with Kirsten Zickfeld saying the long-lived sea level rise from short-term gases like methane mean we absolutely must control emissions of both. I didn't get an exact figure from Kirsten about the global warming potential of methane that her team used. There is more new research about that, this time published in Geophysical Research Letters on December 27, 2016. That's an open-access paper titled Radiative Forcing of Carbon Dioxide, Methane, and Nitrous Oxide, a Significant Revision of the Methane Radiative Forcing. The lead author is Miriam Etmanan at the University of Reading. They find the warming from methane from 1750 to 2011 is about 25% higher than the number used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in their 2013 assessment. You know methane only lasts 12 years or so in the atmosphere before it breaks down into CO2, among other things. But even if we stretch its total warming contribution to 100 years, so we can compare it with carbon dioxide, this new science finds that impact is 14% higher than the IPCC thought. That's a very big change, with methane looking meaner than ever. As you heard, Zickfeld's new work only looked at rising seas due to ocean heating, so-called thermal sea level rise. The authors didn't try to take in the nasty feedback loop from melting permafrost, but even there, another new paper published in the AGU's Geophysical Research Letters on December 29, 2016, urges caution. The authors, led by Brett Thornton, found it tricky to estimate methane coming from the many new ponds forming in the tundra among the wetlands around the Arctic. Improper counting can lead to unintentional double counting of methane, they warn. That would explain why attempts to calculate methane emissions based on ground maps of the Pan-Arctic arrived at much larger figures than the actual methane measured in the air, when we have managed to measure it. It's all a work in progress, meaning we know methane will increase, but we don't yet know by how much. And speaking of great experiments humans can create in nature and shouldn't, I hope you noticed the warning from Kirsten Zickfeld that while we don't know the whole impact of adding so much extra greenhouse gas to the atmosphere, we also don't know the impact of taking them back out again, if we ever manage to do that. Nothing really ever goes back to what it was in nature. In living ecosystems, life moves on to new forms. Unlike Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, we don't really get to go back to Kansas. All we can do is struggle not to unwittingly push ourselves and our plant and animal friends right off the planet. I'm Alex Smith. Find links to all this science and our scientists in my show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock. I know it takes some time out of your life. I hope it's worth it for you. And thank you for caring about our world.